Easter is coming up, and I just can't wait to have the whole family in one place. And of course, what's Easter without an awesome Easter brunch? Now, I don't know about your family, but mine is a little picky, and I really wanted to impress them with something delicious. A friend told me I should check out Total Wine & More. It was crazy! They must have every wine and beer imaginable. I told one of their friendly experts my situation, and they found me just the thing. This sparkling wine is going to be absolutely perfect for brunch, even with my picky family. I know next time I need something, I'm shopping at Total Wine and More.
Blog Talk Radio.
There it goes.
You're listening to New Mexico West Prepping on the Contra Radio Network. Preparing today to survive the day after. I'm your host, Brian.
And I'm your co-host, Eric.
All right. This show, as usual, as is par for the course, is starting off wonderful. My son's laptop decided it needed to update. We're up at our property in the mountains, so we're sitting on top of a hill to connect to the internet, and Windows decided, no, you got to do a mandatory update. So he'll be joining us as soon as Windows finishes its mandatory update. Other than that, basically this show we're going to be discussing wind generation, hydropower. We'll go a little bit into solar again. We've covered a good portion of that, so we won't touch too much on that. We'll go back over MPPT and PWM charge controllers. We will touch bases on the inverters, the various different inverters and pure sine, modified sine, and then go from there. I do not have access to the chat room at this point, so until he gets his laptop up and going, we're going to be kind of blind in the chat room. So if anybody's in the chat room, bear with us, please. I apologize for the issues. So with that said, we're going to go ahead and start with micro hydroelectric. Now, let me just throw this out there at the beginning of this. As far as micro hydro goes, I don't have any water, running water on my property, creeks, streams. So I didn't look into micro hydro with my property. I have looked at properties that had creeks before, and micro hydro is one of the most reliable forms of electricity generation because it never stops. It creates electricity 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, as long as you do not let your water freeze, because that slows that down. So with that being said, micro hydro is a type of hydroelectric power that typically produces from 5 kilowatts to 100 kilowatts of electricity using the natural flow of water. Installations below 5 kilowatts are called picohydro. These installations can provide power to an isolated home or small community, or are sometimes connected to electric power networks, particularly where net metering is offered. There are many of these installations around the world, particularly in developing nations, as they can provide an economical source of energy without the purchase of fuel. Micro hydro systems complement solar power systems because in many areas, water flow and thus available hydropower is highest in the winter when solar energy is at its minimum. Micro hydro is frequently accomplished with a pelt and wheel for high head, low flow water supply. The installation is often just a small dam pool at the top of a waterfall with several hundred feet of pipe leading to a small generator housing. Construction details of a micro hydro plant are site specific. Sometimes an existing mill pond or other artificial reservoir is available and can be adapted for power production. In general, micro hydro systems are made up of a number of components. The most important include the intake, where water is diverted from the natural stream, river, or perhaps a waterfall. An intake structure, such as a catch box, is required to screen out floating debris and fish, using a screen or array of bars to keep out large objects. In temperate climates, this structure must resist ice as well. The intake may have a gate to allow the system to be dewatered for inspection and maintenance. The intake then tunnels water through a pipeline, which is called the penstock, to the powerhouse building containing a turbine. In mountainous areas, access to the route of the penstock may provide considerable challenges. If the water source and turbine are far apart, the construction of the penstock may be the largest part of the cost of construction. At the turbine, a controlling valve is installed to regulate the flow of and the speed of the turbine. The turbine converts the flow and pressure of the water to mechanical. Sorry, Eric's talking to me. The turbine converts the flow and pressure of the water to mechanical energy. The water emerges from the turbine, returns to the natural water course along a tail race channel. The turbine turns a generator, which is then connected to electrical loads. This might be directly connected to the power system of a single building in very small installations, or maybe connected to a community distribution center system for several homes or buildings. Usually micro hydro installations do not have a dam and reservoir like large hydroelectric plants have, relying on a minimal amount of water to be available year-round. All right, now onto the head and flow characteristics. Micro hydro systems are typically set up in areas capable of producing up to 100 kilowatts of electricity. This can be enough to power a home or small business facility. This production range is calculated in terms of head and flow. The higher each of these are, the more power available. I'm trying to help him get his laptop set up. This can be enough to power a home or small business facility. This production range is calculated in terms of head and flow. The higher each of these are, the more power available. Hydraulic head is the pressure measurement of water falling in a pipe expressed as a function of the vertical distance the water falls. This change in elevation is usually measured in feet or meters. A drop of at least 2 feet is required, or the system may not be feasible. When quantifying head, both gross and net head must be considered. Select yes. Studio. Get your headphones in. All right. Oh, sorry about that. Gross head approximates power accessibility through the vertical distance measurement alone, whereas net head subtracts pressure loss due to friction and piping from the gross head. I believe you've ejected me, and I'm not talking anymore, so you're talking. Start talking. All right, so apparently his laptop is having issues. So I apologize about that. So bear with me just a minute. Go ahead and call in. Yes. And we'll just get him to call in. Phone call, so bear with me on this one. All right. Give me just a second here while I try and not just leave it alone. You're not there, are you?
I am.
You're not there. Press something and talk.
Can you hear me?
No, I do not hear you. You hear me? Well, that's just because my phone sucks. It's an iPhone. Well, all right. We'll hope that everyone else can hear me, too. All right. So, the quantity of water falling from the site is usually measured in gallons per minute, cubic feet per second, or liters per second. Low flow, high head installations, and steep terrain have significant pipe costs. A long penstock starts with a low pressure pipe at the top and progressively a higher pressure pipe closer to the turbine in order to reduce pipe costs.
Can you hear me?
I cannot. I don't know why. So Jeff texted me and said he could hear me, so.
Just hang
up. No, you're there.
Okay.
All right, so. Oh, gotta love Verizon and iPhones. Such junk. Anyway, H is the static head and K is the constant of 5,310 gallons. Gallons times feet per minute times kilowatts. For instance, for a system with a flow of 500 gallons per minute and a static head of 60 feet, the theoretical maximum power output is 5.65 kilowatts. You can hear me, right? Okay. The system is prevented from 100% efficiency from obtaining all 5.65 kilowatts due to the real world, such as turbine efficiencies, friction, and piping conversion from potential to kinetic energy. The turbine efficiency is generally between 50 to 80%, and pipe friction is accounted for using the Hazen-Williams equation, which can be found on Google. So, you can't get on there while you're on there. Mm-hmm. All right, so Eric's going to go over small wind turbines, and then I'll pick back up right after that. So there you go, Eric. I don't know. Hang up. You're not in there. All right. So apparently, Eric's not going to be here today. Give me just a minute here while I hand him the phone that is working, since apparently we have a Windows device that sucks because it's Windows and it, you know, has Microsoft in there, and an iPhone, which also sucks. So let me go ahead and hand the earpiece over to Eric while he goes over wind generation. Bear with us. I apologize. This may end up being a very short show. Don't press the center. You'll hang up. Okay. I will be going over small wind turbines. A small wind turbine is a wind turbine used for microgeneration, as opposed to large commercial wind turbines such as those found in wind farms, with greater individual power output. The Canadian Wind Energy Association defines small wind as ranging from less than 1,000 watt turbines up to 300 kilowatt turbines. The smaller turbines may be as small as 50 watt auxiliary power generators for a boat, caravan, or miniature refrigeration unit. Smaller scale turbines for residential scale use are available. Their blades are usually 1.5 to 3.5 meters, or 4 foot 11 inches to 11 feet 6 inches in diameter, and produce 1 to 10 kilowatts of electricity at their optimal wind speed. Some units have been designed to be very lightweight in their construction, example being 11 kilograms, 35 pounds, allowing sensitivity to minor wind movements and a rapid response to wind gusts typically found in urban settings and easy mounting, or much like a television antenna. However, though, you may want to check your area's weather, because if you have an area where there's lots of wind gusts, the wind turbine will can attempt to stop it, but it won't in grinding all the gears and launching propellers in every direction. It is claimed and a few are certified as being inaudible even a few feet, about a meter, under the turbine. The majority of small wind turbines are traditionally horizontal axis wind turbines, but vertical axis wind turbines are a growing type of wind turbine in the small wind market. Makers of vertical axis wind turbines, such as WePower,
Urban Green Energy, Helix Wind, and Windspire Energy have reported increasing sales over the previous years. The generators for small wind turbines usually are three-phase alternating current generators, and the trend is to use the induction type. They are options for direct current output for battery charging and power inverters to convert the power back to AC, but at constant frequency for grid connectivity. Some models utilize single-phase generators. Some small wind turbines can be designed to work at low wind speeds, but in general, small wind turbines require a minimum wind speed of 4 meters per second, 13 feet per second. Dynamic braking regulates the speed by dumping excess energy so that the turbine continues to produce electricity even in high winds. But you have to check your area's weather, because sometimes
too much of a gust
can be a bad thing. The dynamic breaker or braking resistor may be installed inside the building to provide heat during high winds when more heat is lost by the building, while more heat is also produced by the braking resistor. The location makes low voltage, around 12 volt, distribution practical. Small units often have direct drive generators, direct current output, lifetime bearings, and use a vane to point on the wind. Larger, more costly turbines generally have powertrains, alternating current output, and are actively pointed into the wind. Direct drive generators are also used in some large wind turbines. Okay, oh wait, installation. Turbines are often mounted on a tower to raise them above any nearby obstacles. One rule of thumb is that turbines should be at least 30 feet higher than anything within 500 feet. Better locations for wind turbines are far away from large upscale wind obstacles. Measurements are made in a boundary layer. Wind tunnel have indicated that significant detrimental effects associated by nearby obstacles can extend up to 80 times the obstacle's height downwind. However, this is an extreme case. Another approach to sitting a small turbine is to use a shelter model to predict how nearby obstacles will affect local wind conditions. Models of this type are general and can be applied to any site. They are often developed based on actual wind measurements and can estimate flow properties such as mean wind speeds and turbulence levels at a potential turbine location, taking into account the size, shape, and distance to any nearby obstacles. A small wind turbine can be installed on a roof. Installation issues then include the strength of the roof, vibrations, the turbulence caused by the roof ledge. Small-scale rooftop turbines suffer from turbulence and rarely generate significant amounts of power, especially in towns and cities. That is going to be all for small wind turbines. I'm going to hand it back over to my dad.
Here you go.
I see if I can do this without hanging up on everybody.
All right, so, I apologize about the issues here. It's not one thing, it's another. So, next thing we're going to cover briefly is solar power. And we're going to cover some things that we didn't cover last time, and we're going to cover some things that I misquoted last time. It was after I was listening to the show, and I realized I said that wrong. So first off, we're going to go by the misquotes. I had said in the last one not to take your batteries below 30%. What you actually want is not to use more than 30% of your battery's capacity. If you use more than 30% of your battery's capacity, every single time you do that, you lower the length the batteries are going to last. And as such, you're going to end up eventually shortening the life of the batteries drastically. On a side note, I just want to throw it out there again for those who are listening. I do not have access to the chat room. We could not get – you're on the wrong one. We could not get the awesome Windows 10 device to connect to the Blog Talk Radio site and actually connect to it properly. It wouldn't – it's a long story. Anyway, so with that being said, if you're in the chat room, I apologize. If you're trying to call in, I apologize. You know, bear with me. That being said, something else you need to take into consideration, and one of the pictures scrolling through the images is snow. Snow is very detrimental to the creation of electricity. You can ask my son. He will tell you that going out there to brush off the snow once an hour is a very fun job. So, yeah, he just loves that one to death. So, you know, when your panels are covered with snow, there is no light getting through. So you need to size your panels and your system to take that in consideration, or utilize wind power as a backup, as a redundant backup, or hydropower if you have it. You know, things like that are things that you need to take into consideration. We sized our system for our house up here, which is a very small house. And our camper at grand total is going to have 18 panels, 18 190 watt panels, which is just shy of 3400 watts, which is a ridiculous amount of electricity. And the reasoning for that is just for the fact that if you get snow up here, usually within a day or two, it'll melt off. So, you know, you build a battery bank that's large enough to handle your minimal usage, such as your refrigerator deep freeze, and then you just don't use very much else. You know, and that's what you use until you can get the power. And then you go out there every day and, you know, while snowing, and once an hour brush off the snow panels or the snow off the panels. You know, it's the fun things in life that we look forward to. So yeah, solar power is the conversion of sunlight into electricity. Whether directly using a photovoltaics or indirectly using concentrated solar power. Concentrated solar power systems use lenses or mirrors and tracking systems to focus a large area of sunlight into a small beam. They utilize that a lot in the Southwest. Arizona has an absolutely huge concentrated solar power facility that I've driven past many times, and it has all of these huge mirrors that concentrate the sun's light into a boiler in the center, which is used to create electricity. It's a very efficient system. Photovoltaic cells convert light into an electric current using the photovoltaic effect, which you can Google that on Google if you don't know what the photovoltaic effect is. It's not real difficult. Basically, that's converting the sun into energy. You know, we're not going to go over a whole lot of the basic for photovoltaics because we've covered that already, and there's no point in beating a dead horse. I will let you know that when you're powering your system, when you're designing your system, always size your solar panel system larger. Right now, solar panels can be found exceptionally cheap if you look long enough. I ended up paying 54 cents a watt delivered to my door for my solar panels. So the deals are out there. You just have to find them. You're not going to find them at, you know, Bob's House of Solar. You're not going to find them at, you know, sunsolar.com, any of those places like that. You're not going to find them at greenenergy.com. Those places are out to make money. And as such, they're going to make money. They're charging $1.25 to and up for solar panels per watt. You know, you need to go out on eBay is a good place to find them. Go to eBay, and a lot of times you can find a person on eBay, this is what I did, who has an ad on eBay. Contact them and say, hey, I'm, you know, they may have 10 panels available. Hey, I'm looking for 16 panels. Or, hey, I'm only looking for 5 panels. You'd be surprised. People will make you a deal.
And they'll do that deal straight through them because it'll save you money. And it'll save them money, and they make more money that way. And basically what they're doing is using eBay as a marketing ad, basically, to get their information out there so people can contact them and sell panels. The guy that I bought my panels off of had them listed in lots of 10. We ended up, me and a friend of mine, split 30 panels, and we got 30 panels delivered to the house for $3,000. 30 panels at 190 watts is almost 6,000 watts of panel. So, you know, you can do the math at that. It was ridiculously cheap. As such, not everybody has the ability to split that. You know, if we'd have gone with 10 panels, straight from him, it would have cost us about, I think it was $1,400 delivered straight to my door, which is a little bit more, but still, that's less than 75 cents a watt, you know? So you, or right at 70, I think it's like 74 cents a watt, but you know, you just need to look. You don't have to pay exorbitant over the top amounts for the equipment. You just need to do a little bit more research and looking around and find the places where the prices are right. So, you know, with that, we're going to go on to, human power, which is also known as kinetic power, or human kinetic power. I'm sorry, human kinetic energy. I'll get it right here sooner or later. Human kinetic energy can be transferred in a number of ways. Human energy is most commonly used to propel bicycles, but can also be used to generate electricity and power hand crank tools. Some third world organizations are implementing human power technologies to generate electricity to power computers and other appliances. Now, there is so much out there in the industry of human kinetic energy creation devices that until I actually – I knew of some of them and I knew of some of the basic ones, but there are some out there I had no clue about until I started researching this, and it just blew my mind. There is a vehicle called the ELF. It's a pedal-powered solar electric hybrid vehicle. Described as the most efficient vehicle on the planet, the ELF is a solar and pedal-powered hybrid tricycle hand-built in the United States by Organic Transit. It is available in 1, 2, or 3-seater models, and according to their website, it gets the equivalent of 1,800 miles per gallon. 2 gallons of gas, and you're from California to New York. It is legally considered a bicycle, so it can be used on bike paths, parks, and sidewalks, and requires no gas, license, registration, or insurance. On a side note, I'm going to lay money that it also does not come with a heater. So you may want to take that into consideration if you're in like Wisconsin where it's minus 40 tonight. The solar charged electric motor does not power the vehicle, but rather assists you pedaling with a boost of power whenever you need it. The ELF can travel at speeds over 25 miles per hour, and the motor is geared low enough to handle climbing hills with ease. The battery has a range of 16 miles with no pedaling, and 30 miles with pedaling. It takes about 2 to 3 hours to charge using a normal standard wall outlet. Obviously, solar charging times depend on the availability of sunlight, and in direct sunlight, it can be completely recharged in about 8 hours. So, can you go from California to New York direct with that? No. You're going to have to take some breaks to charge it via the solar panel, but I'd be willing to lay money that you could mount yourself a larger solar panel on the roof of that and get a lot more power out of that panel. The next one's Eric's.
Okay, this one is the Hydro-Bee, USB power from nature. I thought this thing was cool looking and it would be really awesome to have. This soda can sized device generates electricity for USB devices when you're off the grid. It can generate power using flowing water, a hand crank, small wind turbine, solar power, pedal power, kinetic energy, hydro, and more. The Hydro-Bee doesn't directly charge devices. Instead, it charges 6 internal AA batteries, which can then be used to charge your devices. Hopefully, this company gets the funding they need to start producing soon, as this would be very helpful to help people in remote and impoverished areas. Oh, you can hold it out of the window of your car whilst you're going down the road, and it'll work. That just sounds awesome. But it has a turbine in the center of it that spins so that it gets the power from the wind and also other, such as like what I said, hydro and rain spout. But that's about it for the hydro bee. Then there's the pedal a watt stationary bike generator. I have the parts to make something similar to this. I already have a motor that's about similar, and I have a bike. I just need the frame. Then I'll have the equivalent of the pedal a watt. Today's twin goals of keeping fit while doing something good for the planet by creating electricity without any pollution comes together in a product that has been around for over 10 years. The pedal a watt stationary bicycle generator. Use your bike along with the pedal a watt stand. It takes 15 seconds to drop your bike in and create anywhere from 100 to 300 watts depending on how strong you are. Then use this energy to power small house appliances, for example, a small home office with a laptop. High-efficient LED light can be run for almost 3 hours on just a 30-minute workout. And that is it for the pedal a watt stationary bicycle generator. I'll hand it back over to my dad. Here you go.
Nice. Goodbye.
Your papers.
All right. And on the pedal a watt. I'm sorry, stationary bike generator. He's corrected me there. I'm going to pick up the parts this summer, I think, and have him go ahead and build that. We'll do a review on his 12-volt generator powered by his bicycle. I have a feeling he'll be a lot less energetic and excited about it once he actually gets on there for half an hour and pedals. But, hey, who knows? We'll see. Forget about solar power. Human power is the future. That may be a little aggressive, but Princeton University engineers have developed a device that may change the way we power many of our smaller gadgets and devices. By using our natural body movements, they have created a small chip that will actually capture and harness that energy to create enough energy to power up things such as a cell phone, pacemaker, and many other small devices that are electronic. The chip is actually a combination of rubber and ceramic nano ribbons. When the chip is flexed, it generates electrical energy. How will this be put to use? Think of rubber-soled shoes that have this chip embedded into them, and every time a step is taken, energy is created and stored. That is awesome. Just the normal walking around inside the office during a normal workday would be enough to keep that cell phone powered every day, all day long. An application that has pacemaker users excited is the fact that this chip could be placed in proximity of the lungs, and it would create natural power for their pacemakers. Every time you breathe in, you just created electricity. That is freaking awesome. Currently, the only way to replace the battery is to go through another surgery, but the natural motion of the lungs would create enough movement to continuously power a device via this chip, thereby eliminating the need to replace your batteries on your pacemaker. You could have a one-time surgery and never have to worry about going in there, you know, short of an actual pacemaker failure. So, I mean, as far as that goes, that is awesome. Finally, only one surgery would be needed unless there was actually a problem with the pacemaker itself. Yeah, I just said that. There would no longer be the need to go under the knife again. This technology is an incredible development in that it can have so many different applications. The engineers at Princeton were able to combine the materials in a way that created an electric charge. When pressure is applied to the chip, it actually converts about 80% of the mechanical energy into electrical energy. In the case of the pacemaker, this means a constant power source, as the lungs would obviously continuously apply the pressure that was needed to create the energy. So, I mean, that is awesome. Next, we're going to go over purchasing of appliances and how to find which appliance is right for your solar power plant. Now, with that being said,
You want the smallest appliance you can possibly get, in some senses. You actually want the smallest appliance you can get amp draw. So when we went out and did some looking around for refrigerators and deep freezes, we went to Lowe's, we went to Home Depot, we went to Wally World. We went all over. And we looked at all kinds of different devices, and we looked at all kinds of different specs. And the ones that weren't listed in the store, we went online and looked them up. We'd take a picture of the box, go home, get online and look up the specs for that device and see where it ranked in with the rest of the ones we were comparing. And what we found is that, wow, there is a big difference in efficient appliances and quote unquote almost efficient appliances. They like to think they're efficient. They classify them as efficient. They even market them as Energy Star compliant. But just because it's Energy Star compliant does not mean that it's as efficient as it can be. For example, we looked and looked and looked at refrigerators. We actually just went and bought a 9.2 cubic foot refrigerator freezer with the freezer on the bottom and the refrigerator on the top. Compared to the 9.9 cubic foot refrigerator and the 14.6 cubic foot refrigerator, and the 4.1 cubic foot that we were currently using, which is like a dorm room, has a freezer and a refrigerator, just not much of a freezer or refrigerator for that matter. But it does serve the purpose, and you know, you can get a gallon of milk and a gallon of orange juice in there and a couple other things. So, you know, the 4.1 cubic foot refrigerator pulled 0.7 amps. The 9.2 cubic foot refrigerator pulled 1.1 amps. The 9.9 cubic foot pulled 1.4 amps. And the 14.6 cubic foot, 0.6 amps. So if you sit there and look at that, the 9.9 and the 9.2, albeit they're smaller, are still plenty large enough to store anything you're going to need in, milk, cheese, eggs, whatever. And they're way more efficient than that 14.6 cubic foot one, which, might I add, all of these devices are classified as Energy Star compliant. If you do the math on that, though, the efficiency of that 14.6 cubic foot refrigerator was nowhere near as high as the 9.9 or the 9.2 cubic foot that we ended up buying. We bought the 9.2 cubic foot because at 1.1 amps draw under cooling current, that is just ridiculously efficient. I was really surprised. You know, it used to be that your refrigerator was going to be one of the larger energy hog items that you would have in your house. At 1.1 amps of energy draw, there's really not much draw there when it comes to the refrigerator anymore. And then for additional storage, when you're going with a smaller refrigerator like that, you need a deep freeze. So if you go to a deep freeze, you start looking at your deep freezes. 6.9 cubic foot deep freeze, 7.1 cubic foot deep freeze, 7.0 cubic foot deep freeze, 5.9 cubic foot deep freeze at Walmart. All right, 5.9 cubic foot at Walmart, I think, was 1.9 or 1.8 amps. I'm sorry, it was 1.7 amps for the 5.9. I didn't write these down, so I apologize. The 7.1 amp and the 7 amp were both 2 amp draw. And the 6.9 amp that they sell at Home Depot is 1.1 amp draw. Now, you tell me, all these are Energy Star compliant devices. So, you know, and if you look around and you look at these things, it's common sense which ones you want to get. So we're going to be picking up that 6.9 cubic foot deep freeze to complement our refrigerator. And total, we're going to have 2.2 amps of draw for cooling. Now, mind you, it won't pull 2.2 amps constantly because it doesn't cool constantly. Your deep freeze is super efficient. So the deep freeze is only going to run for about 10 minutes out of the hour, and your refrigerator only runs for about 10 to 12 minutes out of the hour as well. So if you actually look at that, you're only pulling 1.1 amps for about 10 to 12 minutes on that refrigerator. I've monitored mine with my kilowatt meter, and I don't have the tracking kilowatt meter yet. I'm ordering one when I get back in town tomorrow. I'm still on vacation, so we are still up in the middle of nowhere. But
I'll hook that up next, and that way I can track and give you an actual usage for one day. But I can tell you right now that when the refrigerator is not cycling, which I monitored it for 2 hours, and it cycled twice each time. The first time was for about 6 minutes. The second time was for about 10 minutes. So that's 16 minutes of runtime in 2 hours. And when it's not cycling, it pulls 0.00 amps. It has absolutely zero energy draw. So there is, that's something you need to look into. You get some of these refrigerators, not all of them have that ability. Some of the more energy hog type of refrigerators will have devices in them that run constantly. The ones that have the ice makers, the ones that have the little digital displays on the front, the ones that have the water function and the juice function, all those draw energy constantly. There is actually motors in there and electronic components in there. So those are not going to be really, off-grid compliant. You could use them. Build yourself a big enough system. You can put anything in you want. there's a guy up in Colorado has a 9,000-watt power plant on his 2,200-square-foot house. He runs electric everything, electric heat, electric hot water. He's got big screen TVs. He has no idea of what electrical conservation is or electricity conservation is. And, hey, the guy's got the money. You can't knock him for it, If you got the money, spend it. It's a worthwhile investment. When it comes to me, I am not rich. In fact, I am far from rich. I am probably considered middle class. A lot of people that know me would just consider me a redneck. Some people call me a hillbilly, even though I grew up in Washington, D.C. I very quickly, after I turned 16, moved towards the hills, ended up in West Virginia and then Northern Virginia, and gradually farther and farther from society from there on out. Not counting a brief stint in the military in the middle, but it's when you come to electrical conservation, electricity conservation, and you're picking out appliances that you need for your house, you need to look at all this. You need to do your research. Take the time to look. Just don't run out and buy the prettiest looking appliance that you can find. When it's all said and done, my 18 panels will be able to run my deep freeze, my refrigerator, a 40-inch TV, Xbox One, satellite, internet. We're going to have a wash machine. We're probably going to go with a propane dryer just because it makes more sense economical-wise. However, if I did my drying during the day, we would have enough electricity creation to use an electric dryer during the day. So things like that are things to take into consideration. How much you want to spend, how big you want to go, how much you can afford to spend. If you can afford to buy, 10 panels today, buy the 10 panels. Get the system up and going. Get everything up and going. Solar is one of the few things that you can add on to. And I harp and harp and harp on solar because I am a big fan of solar. With that being said, I also have a 1.6 kilowatt wind generator. It is not installed right now. It will be installed probably by the end of 2017, which is, a year away, give or take 4 or 5 days. It will be going in sometime in the next probably 6 months or so, maybe 8 months. That takes a whole new set of components because my system is designed for solar, not wind generation. So I need to get I need to adjust my setup so that it's capable of handling the surges that you will get with wind generation, with gusts of wind and so on and so forth. And it's really not that much of an additional cost or component cost, and except that my system's only rated at 18 panels. After 18 panels, I don't have the ability to add on to that anymore without buying more components. So, when you're doing your searching for your appliances, look around. Don't just jump on the first one you come to. find more things. On a side note, today we used the microwave on the solar panels for lunch, where we reheated chicken, we reheated steak, we reheated rice. You know, granted it didn't run for a long time, but we got about, it took about 10 minutes total for everything once it was all said and done to warm up. And the system never went off afloat. So it didn't even put enough of a dent in the batteries for the system to decide that it needed to actually go back to bulk charging or absorb charging. It just kept it on float and just topped the system back off again. We have a 900-watt microwave. I intentionally went small on that. I cannot put a turkey in there. I cannot put a roast in there unless it's a small roast. But it has a turntable. It's 900 watts, and it will do what I need it to do, which is make a bag of popcorn, reheat my lunch, you know, whatever, the small things. You know, a microwave, not made for cooking. Microwaves, very inefficient devices. However, I probably could have gone to it with a 1,000 watt and gotten a 1.1 or 1.2 cubic foot. I think mine is 900 watts and 0.9 cubic feet, 0.8 cubic feet. So it's a smaller one. It's not very big. It's my son's over here saying it's about the size, the doors opens about the size of his 15.6 inch monitor on his laptop that refuses to connect to anything because it's such an awesome Windows device. I'm not sure which one's worse, Windows or iPhone. Anyway, back to the appliances. Don't get me started on that. You know, when you're looking for your appliances, do your research. Take the time to go out there and look around. It took me 6 months before I decided which refrigerator I was going to jump on. And then, you know, well, no, I guess it's about four and a half or five months. That we went through looking for, and we went to, like I said, we went to Walmart, we went to Lowe's, we went to Home Depot, we went to Sears, we went to a couple of the other local providers, and none of them had anything remotely near as efficient as this 9.2 cubic foot. And it's got the freezer on the bottom and the refrigerator on the top, which I like because heat rises. Why put your refrigerator up there where the heat's going to go to? It just means your refrigerator is going to have to run more to keep your freezer cold. So, with that being said, well, let's go ahead and roll on to charge controllers. We kind of touched this a few minutes ago, touched this on over the last couple of shows. We're going to kind of give a quick refresher on it. I am using MPPT charge controllers, which is maximum power point tracking. You know, what the heck is an MPPT charge controller? You know, an MPPT, or maximum power point tracker, is an electronic DC to DC converter that optimizes the match between the solar array, PV panels, and the battery bank or utility grid. To put it simply, they convert a higher voltage DC output from solar panels and a few wind generators down to the lower voltage needed to charge batteries. Now, I have mine wired three panels in series, which gives me 117 volts DC at about 10 amps going into my charge controller. I currently have two strands set up like that. Each strand is putting out the same at about 117 volts DC and about roughly 10 to 15 amps per leg. So the highest I've gotten so far was 46 amps going into my batteries. With that being said, every single day when the sun is up, my batteries are 100% charged by about 12 o'clock, 12:30. Today it was about 12:30 because we used the heater a little more last night, and the heater has a fan on it. It's a fireplace, a big fireplace with a fan built into it with a thermostat on the back of it, so it adjusts the fan. We had the heat going. And we also bought the refrigerator yesterday. By the time we got home, it was already dark. So when we were transferring everything over, that refrigerator had to completely cool the refrigerator, which took about 10 minutes. And it actually shut off. So, and again, that when I woke up this morning, my batteries were at 24.6 volts, which is good. They never even got, you know, anywhere near weak. So, these are sometimes called PowerPoint trackers for short.
not to be confused with panel trackers, which is an electric device that goes onto a pole that your panels mount to so that you can... I don't think it's going to work for you, bud. That you can actually connect to your solar panels, and then it takes some power from your solar panels, and it uses that that power from your solar panels to rotate the panels so that they stay tracking on the sun. It can increase the power output of your solar panels. There are some drawbacks to that. One is that you have to grease that regularly. And if you're in a place where there's a lot of sand and dust in the air, like, say, the Southwest, it'll get in there and it'll gum up those motors quick. If you're up in the Midwest, Northeast, Northwest, they're worth the money. The output, the increase, is well worth the money. You get down the Southwest and the Mid-South, not so much the Southeast, but the Southwest and the Mid-South, where you get dust storms and blowing dust, they're just not worth it. The amount of time you have to invest and the amount of energy it actually takes from your panels just doesn't make it worth it. Not when, you know, you're in one of the best areas for solar anyway, without having to use a tracker. All right, so, you know, what does it mean by optimize? Solar cells are neat things. Unfortunately, they are not very smart. Neither are batteries. In fact, batteries are downright stupid. Most PV panels are built to put out a nominal 12 volts. That catch is nominal. In actual fact, almost all 12-volt solar panels are designed to put out from 16 to 18 volts. The problem is that a nominal 12-volt battery is pretty close to actually 12 volts, 10.5 to 12.7 volts, depending on state of charge. Undercharge, most batteries want from around 13.2 to 14.4 volts to fully charge. If you check the charging on your car, that is a perfect example. Your alternator, the charging circuit on your alternator is 14.4 volts. That charges your 12-volt battery to fully charge. That allows your 12-volt battery to fully charge. So, undercharge, most batteries want from around 13.2 to 14.4 volts to fully charge. Quite a bit different than what most panels are designed to put out. Okay, so now we have this neat 130-watt solar panel. Catch number one is that it is rated at 130 watts at a particular voltage and current. The Kyocera KC130 is rated at 7.39 amps at 17.6 volts. 7.39 amps times 17.6 volts equals 130 watts. Now the catch 22. Why does this 130-watt panel not actually put out 130 watts? Where did the watts go? So what happens when you hook up this 130-watt panel to your battery through a regular charge controller? Unfortunately, what happens is not 130 watts. Your panel puts out 7.4 amps. Your battery is setting at 12 volts under charge. 7.4 amps times 12 volts is only 88.8 watts. You lost over 41 watts, but you paid for 130. That 41 watts is not going anywhere. It just is not being produced because there is a poor match between the panel and the battery. With a very low battery, say your battery is at 10.5 volts, it's even worse. You could be losing as much as 35% or 11 volts times 7.4 amps, which is 81.4 watts. You just lost about 48 watts off of your 130-watt panel. One solution you might think of, why not just make panels that they put out 14 volts or so to match the battery? Catch number 22A is that the panel is rated 130 watts at full sunlight at a particular temperature, STC, which is short for standard test conditions. In other words, some guy in a laboratory and God knows where, under perfect conditions. Unfortunately, perfect conditions, not the middle of a mountain in western New Mexico or the middle of a forest in Ohio or Michigan or Idaho or any of that stuff. So standard test conditions do not apply in the field. If any of you have any kind of experience in the field, working on anything, you will know that it doesn't matter what they say,
for what things are rated at, it doesn't work in the field because the field is not optimal like the lab. So, if temperature of the solar panel is high, you don't get 17.4 volts. At temperatures seen in many hot climate areas like New Mexico, you might get under 16 volts. If you started with a 15-volt panel like some of the so-called self-regulating panels, you are in trouble as you won't have enough voltage to put a charge into the battery. Solar panels have to have enough leeway built in to perform under the worst of conditions, like August in New Mexico. The panel will just sit there looking dumb, and your batteries will get even stupider than usual. Nobody likes a stupid battery. All right, so what is maximum power point tracking? There is some confusion about the term tracking. Panel tracking, this is where the panels are on a mount that follows the sun. The most common are the ZoneWorks and WattSun. ZoneWorks is a very good brand. Of all the people I know who have solar trackers, all of them have ZoneWorks. WattSun is supposed to be as good as ZoneWorks. These optimize output by following the sun across the sky for maximum sunlight. These typically give you about a 15% increase in winter and up to 35% increase in summer. This is just the opposite of the seasonal variation for MPPT charge controllers. Since panel temperatures are much lower in winter, they put out more power. And winter is usually when you need the most power from your solar panels due to shorter days. Maximum power point tracking is electronic tracking, usually digital. The charge controller looks at the output of the panels and compares it to the battery voltage. It then figures out what is the best power that the panel can put out to charge the battery. It takes this and converts it to the best voltage to get maximum amps into the battery. Remember, it is amps into the battery that counts. Most modern MPPTs are around 93 to 97% efficient in the conversion. You typically get a 20 to 45% power gain in winter and 10 to 15% in summer. Actual gain can vary widely depending on weather, temperature conditions, battery state of charge, snow, cloudy days, and other factors. That being said, something else that MPPT charge controllers allow you to do is they allow you to run smaller gauge cabling. Higher volts, lower amps, smaller cable. Higher amps, lower volts, bigger cable. Smaller cable, more efficient, because it's easier to push voltage than it is to push amperage. So, if your panels are pushing 117 volts DC at 10 amps, then you're getting a lot more efficiency than you would if they were pushing, say, 36 volts at 30 amps. So, you know, it's more efficient, it's more cost efficient, more cost effective. You know, as far as charge controllers go, it's like a no-brainer. Grid tie systems are becoming more popular as the price of solar drops and electric rates go up. There are several brands of grid tie only. That means there's no battery, which I just find to be like a gun with no bullets. You have a club, like a car with no gasoline. Get out and push. But, hey, people are into that kind of thing, so, you know, it's green. You know, anyway, so there's several brands of grid tie only inverters available. All of these have built-in MPPT charge controllers. Efficiency is around 94 to 97% for the MPPT conversion on those. You know, how does maximum power point tracking work? You know, how does the actual dirt down in the dirt work for MPPT charge controllers? Here's where the optimization or maximum power point tracking comes in. Assume your battery is low at 12 volts. An MPPT takes that 17.6 volts at 7.4 amps and converts it down so that what the battery gets is now 10.8 amps at 12 volts. Now you still have almost 130 watts and everyone is happy. No stupid panel, no stupid battery, no stupid controller. Ideally, for 100% power conversion, you need to be right next to the sun. But anyway, for 100% power conversion, you would get around 11.3 amps at 11.5 volts. But you have to feed this battery a higher voltage to force the amps in, and this is a simplified explanation. In actual fact, the output of the MPPT charge controller might vary continually to adjust for getting the maximum amps into the battery. An MPPT tracks the maximum power point, which is going to be different from from the STC, or standard test conditions, rating under almost all conditions. Under very cold conditions, a 120-watt panel is actually capable of putting out over 130-plus watts because the power output goes up as panel temperature goes down. So in Wisconsin, those panels, if they weren't buried under 6 feet of snow, would be cranking out some power. But if you don't have some way of tracking that power, you're going to lose it. On the other hand, under very hot conditions, like, I don't know, New Mexico in August, or Arizona in August, which I'm actually looking at the power plant in Arizona right now from the hill next to my property, the power drops. You lose power as the temperature goes up. That is why you get less gain in summer. MPPTs are most effective under these conditions, winter and or cloudy or hazy days when the extra power is needed the most. Cold weather, solar panels work better at cold temperatures, but without an MPPT, you're losing most of that. Cold weather is most likely in winter, time when summer, when sun hours are low and you need the power to recharge batteries the most. Low battery charge. If you have a battery bank that's not big enough for everything you're pulling out of it at night, the lower the state of charge in your batteries, the more current an MPPT puts into them. Another time when the extra power is needed the most. You can have both of these conditions at the same time, winter and low batteries. Long wire runs. If you're charging a 12-volt battery and your panels are 100 feet away, A, I don't know who designed your system, but you should probably not hire them to design your system. And B, if you designed your own system, you should probably not design that system again. You should make something a little closer. My runs are about 12 feet for one for the first strand and about 16 feet for the second strand. The voltage drop and power loss can be considerable unless you use very large wire. That can be very expensive. If you have not priced wire, good Lord, it is expensive. But if you have four 12-volt panels wired in series for 48 volts, the power loss is much less, and the controller will convert that high voltage to 12 volts at the battery. That also means that if you have a high voltage panel set up feeding the controller, you can use much smaller wire, which I discussed earlier. I am using 8-gauge wire going to the charge controller and 4-gauge wire from the charge controller to the batteries and to the inverter, which works just fine. Some people tell you need larger gauge wire, but I really don't have a lot of draw out of my batteries at any one point in time. It's not like I'm not going to pull 60 amps out of my batteries at one time. At the most, I'm pulling 5 or 6 amps out of my batteries at a time. So when you're doing your gauging of your system and your wires, you need to take all that into consideration. Yes, larger gauge wire is more efficient, a lot more efficient. If you're running 117-volt DC at 10 amps, 18 or 20 feet on 8-gauge wire, it's going to be more efficient on 6-gauge. There's just no way around it. It's going to be more efficient. And on 4-gauge, it's overkill because there's not that much of an efficiency gain over the 6-gauge. But the difference is the cost, and you're going to double the cost of your wire by going from 8-gauge to 4-gauge. My efficiency loss on 8-gauge wire is 0.07%, which is very good for the voltage I'm pushing. So there are many calculators online. Go online. Do a search for 12-volt DC calculator, wire gauge calculator, and there are a ton of them on there. Just get on there and figure out what your run's going to be, figure out what your voltage drop is going to be. You want to keep it low, the lower the better. The PowerPoint tracker is a high-frequency DC to DC converter. They take the DC input from the solar panels, change to high-frequency AC, and convert it back down to a different DC voltage and current to exactly match the panels to the batteries. Whoever came up with the design for this, way smarter than me. MPPTs operate at very high audio frequencies, usually in the 20 to 80,000 hertz range. The advantage of high-frequency circuits is that they can be designed with very high-efficiency transformers and small components. The design of high-frequency circuits can be very tricky because the problems with portions of the circuit broadcasting, just like a radio transmitter, and causing radio and TV interference, noise isolation, and suppression becomes very important. There are very few non-digital, that is linear, MPPTs charge controllers around.
These are much easier and cheaper to build and design than the digital ones. They do improve efficiency somewhat, but overall the efficiency can vary a lot, and we have seen a few lose their tracking point and actually get worse. That can happen occasionally if a cloud passed over the panel. The linear circuit searches for the next best point, but then gets too far out of the deep end to find it again when the sun comes out. Thankfully, not many of these are around anymore. There is the EP Ever Tracer 4210 charge controllers that I have as backups. They are very good. However, they are not as good as your top-of-the-line ones. They are a mid-grade MPPT charge controller. They run about $150 a piece for a 40-amp charge controller. They're capable of handling 100 volts DC input, so you can actually plan that on your panels. Two 24-volt panels together will give you about 77 to 78 volts DC input into them, and they work very good with that. I'm currently using two of those on my camper. Those will eventually go away once I finish building the system completely on the house, because then the camper will actually be wired into the circuit on the house, slowly but surely. So, the PowerPoint tracker and all DC to DC converters operate by taking the DC input current, changing it to AC, running through a transformer, usually a toroid or a donut-looking transformer, and then rectifying it back to DC, followed by the output regulator. In most DC to DC converters, this is strictly an electronic process. No real smarts are involved except for some regulation of the output voltage. Charge controllers for solar panels need a lot more smarts, as light and temperature conditions vary continuously all day long, and battery voltages change. Smart power trackers. All recent models of digital MPPT controllers available are microprocessor controlled. The EP Ever and the Midnight Solar that I have are both microprocessor controlled MPPT charge controllers. They work very well. In most DC to DC, charge controllers for solar panels need a lot more smarts, as light and temperature conditions vary all day long. I already read that. Sorry, I got sidetracked there. They know when to adjust the output that is being sent to the batteries, and they actually shut down for a few microseconds and look at the solar panels and battery and make any needed adjustments. Although not really new, the Australian company AERL had some as early as 1985. It has been only recently that electronic microprocessors have become cheap enough to be cost-effective in smaller systems, less than 1 kilowatt of panels. MPPT charge controllers are now manufactured by several companies such as Outback Power, Xantrex, Blue Sky Energy, which Blue Sky Energy has very good reviews to, Apollo Solar, Midnight Solar, which is what I use, Morningstar, which is what my brother used, and he liked that a lot. It was a very good charge controller too, and a few others. So, pulse width modulation. Pulse width modulation is the most effective means to achieve constant voltage battery charging by switching the solar system controller's power devices. When in PWM regulation, the current from the solar array tapers according to the battery's condition and recharging needs. The pulse width modulation controller is in essence a switch that connects a solar array to the battery. The result is that the voltage of the array will be pulled down to near that of the battery. The MPPT controller is more sophisticated and more expensive. It will adjust its input voltages to harvest the maximum power from the solar array. Pulse width modulation does not do that. The resultant twin strengths of an MPPT controller. The MPPT controller will harvest more power from the solar array. The performance advantage is substantial. 10 to 40% when the solar cell temperature is low or very high, or when irradiance is very low, such as on cloudy days. At high temperatures or low irradiance, the output voltage of the array will drop dramatically. More cells must then be connected in series to make sure that the output voltage of the array exceeds battery voltage by a comfortable margin. Lower cabling costs and or lower cabling losses, such as I discussed earlier. Ohm's law tells us that losses due to cable resistance RPC, or watt, equals RC times I squared, where RC is the resistance of the cable. What this formula shows is that for a given cable loss, cable cross-sectional areas can be reduced by a factor of 4 when doubling the array voltage. In the case of a given nominal power, more cells in series will increase the output voltage and reduce the output current of the array. P equals volts times resistance. Thus, if P doesn't change, then I must decrease when V increases. Impedance, sorry. As array sizes increase, cable length will increase. The option to wire more panels in series and thereby decrease the cable cross-sectional area with the result in drop in cost is a compelling reason to install an MPPT controller as soon as the array power exceeds a few hundred watts, a 12-volt battery, or several hundreds of watts, 24-volt or 48-volt batteries. Like I said, I'm going to be pushing just shy of 3,400 watts when I'm completely done, well over what is recommended for pulse width modulation. Pulse width modulation is very good in what it does. It is a basic, generic charge controller. It takes the power and converts it to the battery's power. The pulse width modulation charge controller is a good, low-cost solution for small systems. Now, as far as prepping and end of the world as we know it and shit hits the fan and whatever you want to call it goes, if you have a solar power plant, even if it's only 1,000 watts, and you're running an MPPT charge controller, you do not have to buy a second MPPT charge controller to stick into your Faraday cage, if you have a Faraday cage. If you do not have a Faraday cage, go to Google and do some research on stainless steel trash cans as Faraday cages. Are they 100% perfect? No, they are not. They are also not $4,000 to $6,000, which is what the equivalent cost is for a Faraday cage the size of a stainless steel trash can. So, are they effective? Somewhat. And anything is better than nothing. Because, as EMPs go, solar flares go, we don't know how it will affect our system. So, is any kind of protection better than no protection? Yes. You know, anything is better than nothing. If you have a pair of underwear on and you go out of your house, you're not going to get arrested. If you don't have underwear on, you're going to get arrested. Anything is better than nothing. So, if you're going to be putting something into a Faraday cage for a backup in the case of an emergency situation or an end-of-the-world situation, pulse width modulation charge controllers are about $40 a pop. Buy four, buy six, throw them in there. Make sure you've insulated the interior so it's not touching metal. Throw them in there gently because they are indeed electronic devices, and, you know, electronics don't respond well to being thrown. But throw them in there and keep them as backups, because in the event that the economy collapses or there's a terrorist attack on the grid and the grid goes down, you know, if your charge controller eventually has an issue, which sooner or later everything has issues, it's going to be a lot easier if you have a backup than if you don't. If you can afford one of the cheaper, like one of the Tracer series charge controllers, MPPT charge controllers, like what I'm using as backups. I also have pulse width modulation charge controllers in my trash can as backups, but I have some MPPTs as well. So I have a total of 5 charge controllers, 3 pulse width modulation and 2 MPPTs. You know, if you have the money, spend it. You know, it doesn't do you any good sitting in the bank. That does not mean go out and blow your entire paycheck on, because you're going to be in a worse situation than when you started. But put a little bit back each week. Put $10 a week back. In 4 weeks, you have enough money to buy a pulse width modulation charge controller. It's that simple. $10 a week. Don't go to McDonald's one day that week. Don't go to Starbucks one day that week. And you can afford to buy a charge controller in 4 weeks. It's that simple. You know, what do we prep for as a family? We prep more for a EMP or a solar flare event, because if you look at that, if you're prepared for a EMP or a solar flare event, you're pretty much prepared for anything else that's going to happen. If a tornado comes through, you're prepared. as long as it doesn't hit you directly. Cane comes through. Again, as long as it doesn't hit you directly, you're prepared. If the grid goes down because of terrorist attack, you're prepared. Economic collapse, you're prepared because you have everything you need to run a small setup. So you're living in town in a freaking house, and you don't think that the homeowners association would be really keen on you putting in this huge solar power plant in your yard. Okay, so go buy 3 panels. Put in some privacy fencing in a spot in your yard. Put your solar panels on a ground mount. That is a small mount where they're about 3 inches off the ground on one side and about 3.5 feet off the ground on the other side. Angle them where they're going to get the most sun. Run that wiring to your garage. Follow all of the codes for your county. If you need to pull a permit, pull a permit. If you need to, you know, whatever, have it inspected, have it inspected. Make sure you do everything by code. Don't let it come back and bite you in the butt later. Put in a small plant. 3 panels. 3 200-watt panels is enough to run a small refrigerator. If the grid goes down, it's enough to run a small deep freeze. If the grid goes down and you have the ability to keep your food cold, you're going to be a lot better off than if you don't have that ability, you know. 600 watts will run a small deep freeze and a couple of LED lights and a small 12-volt fan like they sell at Walmart. Do a small setup. There's nothing says that you have to do anything extravagant. If you can add on to it later, add on to it. If you have enough room and it's out of sight enough that your neighbors aren't going to complain to the homeowners association, then buy 3 panels. Put them in place. Later on down the road when the money comes up, buy 3 more. It's almost tax time. You know what happens at tax time? For about 60% of America, they get these really, really big paychecks, which is what that is. They get a really, really big paycheck because you can't tell me that somebody who's making $20,000 a year put in $7,000 or $8,000 or $9,000 in taxes. So what you get is essentially the government redistributing the wealth through taxes. So is that a bad thing? We won't go into that today. That's a whole another topic we'll get into some other day. But as far as that goes, if you're somebody who's receiving a big tax check, or even if you're only receiving $1,000, you know, I'm going to break even, I think, about where I'm at. I may make a little bit, but not very much. I actually have more taxes taken out all year long so that I don't have any surprises at the end of the year. And if I get a little bit of a check back, well, then so be it. But I don't get much. There were times back in my past where I'd get a $9,000 check because I made, you know, $25,000 for the entire year. If you get a big check like that, if you get a $1,000 check, you can pretty much build a 3-panel system from a $1,000 check. No, you can't go out and buy the latest and greatest new big TV with that. And you probably can't, you know, go out and put a down payment on a car too. But you can do something that's going to come in handy for your family in the future if you should ever need it. And, you know, personal choice. Do what you got to do. If you're listening to this show, chances are, if you're going to get a check like that, look into it. Go do some research. If you're not ready to buy a setup like that, look into buying energy-efficient appliances. They will save you a lot of money over the year. You know what you spend each month on electric. If you buy an energy-efficient appliance, most electric companies, when they send you your bill out, will show you what your bill was the 12 months previous. Take the difference of that, if you replace your appliances with energy-efficient appliances, can be quite a large amount, as much as $60 to $100 a month. Take that money and put that into either a safe location or a savings account or set it off to the side, whatever. And when you have enough, take that $1,000. 10 months, you've got $1,000. Take that $1,000, go buy your panels and your setup and get yourself started. You are no worse off, and this is exactly how me and my wife sat down and talked about it. And finally, we came to the conclusion, if nothing ever happens, if the economy doesn't collapse because we're at $20 trillion in debt, think about that amount for a second, and our government has no clue on how to do a balanced budget, and 62% of Americans are receiving some kind of financial benefit from the country's government,
We're in a horrible situation, you know. We are in a situation where economic collapse is not just possible, it's probable, you know. So, but if nothing ever happens, if through the act of God, Donald Trump pulls off a miracle and fixes the economy, I'm okay with that. I'm not wishing for that. I'm just prepping just in case. But if that were to happen and nothing ever happens, there's no EMP, there's no solar flare from the sun like the Carrington event in 1859, there's no economic collapse, there's no terrorist attack on the grid, how much worse off am I when I go to retire in 20 years if I have zero bills because my house is paid for, my property is paid for, I'm on solar for power, well for water, I have no bills. Septic tank for my, you know, where am I going wrong there? Where am I missing, you know, what do I not have? Okay, so here's what I don't get. I don't get a new car every year. I'm driving a 1996 Ford F-250 that I paid $2,500 for. It's got 223,000 miles, and except for the fact that the new power steering pump that I just put on at Wines and is going to get replaced as soon as I get back in town because it has a lifetime warranty, it runs like a top. It's got a gooseneck hitch in the bed. It's got a 460, which guzzles gas like, you know, ridiculous. But on the way up here, I got 13.78 miles per gallon out of a 460, which is pretty good. You know, I have a 2000 Mazda 626. It's got the 2.5 V6 in it. I wish it had the four-cylinder because the 2.5 V6 in the Mazda is really, really peppy. Very poor gas mileage, like 26 miles per gallon on a good day. I've got a 1996 Explorer, four-wheel drive. So if you look at that, I've got a truck for working. I've got a car for traveling, and I've got an SUV with four-wheel drive for driving in the snow. Are all those new vehicles? No. Have I put a lot of money into any of them? No. Will I put a lot of money into any of them? No. I'll go out and buy another vehicle that needs minimal repairs and pay a little bit of money for it. You know, of all of my vehicles, I paid the most for that Mazda because it had 70,000 miles on it when I bought it 2-3 years ago. You know, so, you know, it as far as that goes, you know, I won't get a new TV every year. Okay, well, that just means I'll have to watch my football on my 40-inch instead of, you know, whatever the latest and greatest is. I think now they got 50-inch for like $338. Not going to get a 50-inch TV as much as I would like it. But, you know, that's because I'm spending my money on more responsible things. 20 years ago? No. My brother, who, if I could get into the chat room, would tell you readily, 20 years ago, I was probably one of the most irresponsible people in the United States. I have done some of the most retarded, stupid, idiotic things in my life, and through the good graces of the Lord, I have not died. It doesn't mean I haven't put myself in positions where I probably should have had a lot more injuries than I did, but like I said, through the good graces of the Lord, he watched out over me even when I wasn't, you know, religious. You know, but no, responsibility is not everybody's cup of tea. It doesn't come immediately. It happens over time. You know, I guess it's one of those things of getting older. It took me a long time to get to where I'm at today. And, you know, everything that's happened to me in my past has made me who I am. So, no, I would not change any of it. Yes, I have made some really stupid mistakes. I will not get into them because that's all personal stuff. But I have, suffice it to say, I have made some really, really, really stupid mistakes in my life. And as such, you know, they cost me dearly. But they make me who I am today. I have a better respect for life. I have a better respect for what we have in America. You know, when you go overseas and you see third world countries that have kids digging in trash cans for dinner that night, and then you come back here and the little 15-year-old kids down the street are whining because they don't have an iPhone, dude, we have no concept. Someday that will come to America, I have a feeling. Venezuela. Look at Venezuela. Venezuela. Look at Argentina. Argentina was a very prosperous country. And yet, through mismanagement of money, through government overspending, their economy collapsed in the late 1990s and early 2000s. And it was horrible. I have gone into that a little bit in the past, and there's a couple of people that, you know, I listened to who went through that and actually went through that, not from America. They were in Argentina. And those people, preparedness, they are a wealth of information. People don't understand. When Argentina collapsed, this is an example that I use a lot, because this just shows you, it explains to you in one sentence exactly how bad it was. When the economy collapsed in Argentina, upper class women were trading their bodies for a can of ravioli to feed their kids. That is how bad it got. Will it get like that in America? I hope not. But if it does, I'll be well off out here in the middle of freaking nowhere on my property. So, with that being said, I think I've rambled probably long enough. I'm going to cut this one short for now. And we'll try this again next week, where I actually have internet and computers that aren't mad at me for some unknown reason. So, next three shows are going to. The next three shows are going to cover gardening. Now, gardening. Get out there with your little flowered apron. No, I'm not talking about gardening flowers in your front yard. I'm talking about gardening for life, for food. We're going to cover everything from ground preparation, dirt preparation, to whether you should use raised beds or in-the-ground planting, to drip irrigation and irrigation, to what seeds you need to plant, what's going to grow in your area. These seed-saving vaults are horrible. They get in there and they're like, hey, we will give you everything you need to feed your family for a year in this one box for $99.99. BS. Half that stuff won't even grow where you live at. And on top of that, most people, if they put those seeds in the ground, are going to get about 10% growth out of that anyway, because there's no prep going into it. So we're going to cover prepping the dirt. We're going to talk about raised beds. We're going to talk about seeds. We're going to talk about mulch, fertilizers, organic fertilizers. We're going to talk about pesticides, organic pesticides. We're going to talk about harvesting your food and seed saving, which is one of the most important things about gardening, and especially gardening for survival, is seed saving. If you cannot save seeds, you will die of starvation, because after your first harvest, you have nothing left to plant. So you need to learn how to seed save. And so we're going to cover seed saving. We're going to cover basically every single aspect of gardening in your backyard. We'll go over how much of a garden you need to feed a family of four, and it is a large one, trust me. We'll go over what you're going to need to grow, what'll grow in your area. We're in the Southwest, but we're in the Southwest at 7,000 feet, which is more along the lines of Colorado than it is New Mexico. So we're going to cover all this stuff in the upcoming episode, and then we'll go from there. The next three episodes, it's going to be a three-part series on that. So I look forward to seeing everybody there and talking to them, blabbing about things that people have probably heard 1,000 times over. So with that being said, I want to thank you for listening to New Mexico West Prepping on the Contra Radio Network. We look forward to talking to you next week, and God bless.
Welcome to Total Wine & More. It's much more than a wine store. It's the eighth wonder of the world.
When people talk about Total Wine & More, they get a little carried away. We're just a big, friendly place run by people with a passion for wine and beer. See, we travel the world to find the best wines from the best regions, and we sell them at the lowest prices anywhere.
And friendly, helpful experts at every turn.
You know what? Maybe we are the eighth wonder of the world.
Shop in-store or online at TotalWine.com.
Easter is coming up, and I just can't wait to have the whole family in one place. And of course, what's Easter without an awesome Easter brunch? Now, I don't know about your family, but mine is a little picky, and I really wanted to impress them with something delicious. A friend told me I should check out Total Wine & More. It was crazy. They must have every wine and beer imaginable. I told one of their friendly experts my situation, and they found me just the thing. This sparkling wine is going to be absolutely perfect for brunch, even with my picky family. I know next time I need something, I'm shopping at Total Wine & More. And more.